back?
I just think it's important for everyone not to back down on their own values and not to be afraid to confront that. And whether it's on the national level or your own local bargain or anything like that, you know, when you accept a rollback or you don't fight back, then you spread that to other groups. And when you stand up and you fight back, you also empower others. So, you know, something on the national scale can be overwhelming, like what role can I have? But what we're doing in our small work with every day and standing up there will have that effect, I believe, in some of my role in making it all a better place.
I encourage people to start with any community organization that they're currently in. That includes unions or other community groups, faith-based organizations. There's just an explosion of energy and ideas right now. And you're going to find opportunities to participate through your community organization, and you'll end up linking with other community organizations. I suggest people find a network that they trust, whether it's on Facebook or something. Will also provide information about activities and how they can move forward. And I certainly second what Suzanne said is, you know, the way we handle the present is going to determine what our future is. So let's handle it with courage and with unity.
Suzanne and Steve, thank you. Stay strong in the struggle. Listeners, please do that also. Tune in next week for more Labor Radio. Stay tuned now for Prison Pipeline. Thanks to our engineer. Good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Good evening. I'm Doug McVeigh. In 1994, Oregon voters approved Ballot Measure 11, the Oregon Mandatory Sentences for Listed Felonies Act. The measure was sold to Oregon voters as a necessary step for controlling crime. Measure 11 was sold to voters as a set of laws that would apply to adults who had committed the worst sorts of violent crimes. Oregon voters were sold a bill of goods. In reality, would ever consider violent or particularly heinous qualify for mandatory minimum sentencing due to Measure 11? A report in 2011 found that following passage of Measure 11, about 61% of young people generally took plea deals that resulted in adult convictions. Additionally, the report argued that Measure 11 has done nothing to reduce the juvenile crime rate and forces young people into adult jails. Our guest today on Prison Pipeline, Jessica Tibbetts, was only 14 years old when she committed the offenses for which she was sentenced under Measure 11. She had survived a lifetime of abuse and neglect at the hands of her parents. The social services system that should have protected her failed abysmally. Jessica is a survivor. She served 15 years of a life sentence before she was finally given a second look. She has rehabilitated, in spite of the odds, in spite of the barriers and hurdles that she's had to overcome, in spite of our criminal justice system. Tonight, we're going to hear part one of Jessica's story.
My name is Jessica Tibbetts, and I spent 15 years. I was 14 for aggravated murder and criminal conspiracy. I mean, the original indictment had a bunch of stuff on it, but I actually got convicted of aggravated murder and criminal conspiracy. In a nutshell, just put my crime in a real serious nutshell. When I was 14, I went through quite a bit of abuse, abusive parents, a lot of neglect, and I met a 23-year-old guy who had just gotten out of the Army. He was still in his Army dress clothes. He came to pick me up at my high school one day at lunch. We had closed campus in Chiloquin, and his name was Ray, and I was like, oh, this guy's cool. He's over 21. He can drive a car, and he was in the Army. So to me, that represented safety from my dad, because, you know, that guy could probably beat him up if my dad comes after me. Plus, you know, to a 14-year-old girl, a guy who's over 21, and, you know, so he can go everywhere, and he can get anything that we need or want. But also, he did Army. He was in the Army. So, you know, that's, I guess it represented security. I was like a serial runaway. Kept running away. I experienced a lot of sex abuse, things like that. And when I was in and out of like shelters and stuff, and I went to a shelter shortly before everything happened, and when I called home one day, my mom said there was somebody there that wanted to talk to me. And I was like, okay. And I was thinking, you know, like my cousin or something had come. No, it was my boyfriend. She had moved my 23-year-old boyfriend into my house. I was still in a protective custody shelter at the time. But, you know, hey, what's not cool about that, right? You know, 14, now your boyfriend lives in your room. Whoa. But things got a little crazy. You know, there was, my parents and I always fought anyway. And to make a long story short, I wanted out of that house anyway, any way that I could get out of that house. And he had said he was going to kill him. And, you know, at some points we'd both, I guess, what the state's called conspired, but I'd got off and been like, I don't give a what you do. Just do whatever, you know, I just want out. Let's run away. And I remember I told him, let's run away. And he said, well, I can't take a juvenile across state lines. He could kill people, but he couldn't take anyone across state lines. You know, and when I was 14, it didn't occur to me how skewed, like, that thought process is. Let's make a long story short, I just got into a really adult situation. And some stuff happened, and he ended up killing my mom and my brother with a hatchet. And I was there, and I saw it, and I froze. I froze like a deer caught in the headlights. And I remember just saying, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, because I was like 2 feet from my mom when this happened. And it's surreal. I think mentally I just checked out. And he killed them both in front of me. And people are like, well, you held your brother. Well, I didn't hold my brother. He split my brother's head open. My brother went to move past me. I grabbed my brother by the shirt and I said, you know, finish it. I can't stand to see him like this. And I let him go. And he continued to run past me. But it means I took a physical part in my crime. So I was charged with aggravated murder and criminal conspiracy, which, you know, I have to live with that. Whether people are think I should die, or, you know, there are those people that say I should be executed. Well, I was 14. I didn't mean for that stuff to happen. You know, I didn't with intent say, hey, you know, they made it out, you know, like I'm some psycho. I used to call myself psycho killer daughter from hell. From the papers and everything. But it wasn't like I was intentionally trying to get somebody killed. I was trying to get out of that situation. I didn't want to be raped anymore. I didn't want to be sold by my parents, bartered away to weird old guys that they got money from. I wanted to go to school. I mean, if you guys can pull my school records if you can find them. I never went to school. I wanted to be an honor roll kid. I wanted to be in sports. I had dreams. You know, I wanted to be just, I think I wanted to be the stereotypical kid that most parents want their kids to be. You know, I just wasn't allowed to be. It was always expected that I would either go to prison, end up in a ditch, or end up pregnant. I grew up knowing that. I never grew up thinking, maybe I'll go to college. College never even came up. Like, nobody ever mentioned college to me. Like, nobody even thought I would graduate. And, you know, those things are what I grew up with. And it's difficult looking back on everything. And obviously I feel a lot of guilt, a lot of shame. I do feel like I should have stopped it. If I would have stopped it, he would have killed me. But it probably would have been better to die than to live with what happened. It would have made my family a lot happier if I would have. But I didn't. I was measure 11 at 14. And everyone says, oh, measure 11 only starts when you're 15. No, actually, I am the exception to the rule. And thus far, I believe I'm the only exception that's ever happened. You can be measure 11 when you are 14 years old. They remand you to adult court and they measure 11 you. I got life with a 30-year minimum, with a second look after 15 years. I didn't know how to fight the charges. Like, I was like, I didn't even touch the weapon. I don't understand how I'm guilty of murder. But under the measure 11 laws, if you're there and you know about it and you don't stop it or die, no matter that he did 5 years in the army, that he told people long before he ever met me that he wanted to know what it felt like to kill somebody. All that mattered was that I was there and I didn't stop it, and he had talked about it. And, you know, I didn't take it seriously. People, when you're young, they say that they're going to do that stuff all the time. Well, where I grew up, they do. I don't know that it happens everywhere. People get mad. I'll kill you, you know. They, all kinds of stuff. But it doesn't really happen. In my case, it did. So I pled no contest. I think I had just turned 16, spent my sweet 16 being moved from juvenile detention to a county jail. Got moved into a jail cell with somebody detoxing from heroin, puking up these little orange balloons in my cell. And I kept trying to feed her to make her feel better because she just kept throwing up and it was horrific. And in those cells, there's like no privacy. It's not like she gets to go into the bathroom. The bathroom is the cell. And so they're just puking and just all over the place. And she kept trying to get me to take the stuff out of the little balloons. I was like, nope. I had seen drugs and I didn't want any part of that. So I didn't know how to fight these charges. I mean, people go to law school for years to be able to navigate the criminal justice system and advocate so that, you know, quote unquote, the scales of justice are balanced, which is a crock because the justice system is like the definition of injustice. It's not very effective in the way that we have it lined out. And it's not very restorative. It's retributive justice as opposed to restorative. It's not restoring our communities. It's not to not reoffend. It's mass incarceration of individuals who have a high level of criminality already, and then when they get in there, they don't qualify for the programs to rehabilitate. So, yeah, I mean, it's not very effective the way we have it lined out. It's pretty much college for criminals, a way for you to learn how to get away with the stuff that you perhaps didn't get away with previously. And so that whole thing is part of the problem. But I got a second look. That was the only way that they could get me with an aggravated murder charge. And I got life with a 30-year minimum. And this whole plea bargain thing, pretty much everyone takes a plea bargain because everyone's too afraid to try to go to trial, whether you're guilty or innocent. It doesn't matter. You don't want to go to trial because if a jury of your peers, who, unless they got a bunch of 14-year-olds or 15-year-olds on a jury panel, wouldn't have been my peers. But if a jury of my peers, quote unquote, are going to do that, then bottom line is I was scared. So I took a plea bargain and they said, well, you can either go in for life with a 6-year minimum and a second look after 30 years, or you can take life with a 30-year minimum and a second look after 15 years. And I was like, okay, a second look. Well, what does that mean? They're like, well, it means the judge will look at you and decide if you can get out in 15 years. And I was like, okay. So I signed the paperwork, and I remember the day that I signed my plea bargain in Klamath County. Judge Osborne was out. That's my judge. And Judge Wogan was up there. And the court clerk, I don't remember her name, but when that plea bargain came in front of me, when it came time for me to sign it, the judge looked at me and he goes, you understand you don't have to do this. You do not have to sign this. You don't have to do that. And I remember crying, and my exact words were, I don't know what else to do. I don't know how to fight this. And there's the injustice and the justice here. I just turned 16. I was traumatized. I had PTSD before my crime. And now I'm having to make a decision on something called a second look that nobody's ever had before. It just means I get to talk to my judge again. So I'm hanging my entire future based on the hope that, please God, let her still be on the bench and let her see that I'm not everything everyone made me out to be.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, and we're listening to an interview with Jessica Tibbetts, the youngest person in Oregon to have been sentenced under Oregon's harsh Measure 11 mandatory minimum sentencing laws. Let's get back to Jessica.
And so I went into Hillcrest from there for 2 years. I got intaked at like OWCC, and then I went into Hillcrest. I was at Hillcrest for about 2 years, and that was one of the most mentally and emotionally abusive places I've ever been. You know, they were like, why are you wasting my time? You have a life sentence. You're a waste of my time. You do just need to go to prison. You're never going to get out. Nobody's ever going to let you out. Look at what you're in here for. And, you know, I was suicidal, and they told me I was reoffending my victims because I felt suicidal. And so there's what's called a waiver in juvenile courts that if you're from adult corrections and you're not sentenced as a juvenile, you can choose to sign a piece of paper that says, I'm not going to stay in juvenile prison. I'm going to go to adult prison. And so I did that. I went to adult prison. I think it was at 8. I was 18 when I signed it. And I went upstate. And the first thing that happened is I got preyed on by a female sex offender as a child, you know, and the predatory nature in there, everything's predatory. And I didn't have family. I didn't really have support. I didn't have any parental people to look to, really. I was pretty alone for the most part. I had somebody I call my grandpa who took me off the streets when I was 5 and would take me to church and stuff. And he supported me through everything. And when he could, he sent me money and he would visit me. He's 99 years old today and he still loves me and supports me. He's my angel. And then my little sister, Alicia, she met me on that church bus and she stood by me through everything. She was 13 when I went to prison, and her parents did not let her come or see me until I was 18. And that's when she first came to see me in prison. And she brought her brand new baby, my niece Gabriella, on my 21st birthday. That was the first time I really had contact with people that I loved. And she was adopted as a child, so like we were both displaced. I had just came out of a foster home. She had been adopted. We were, you know, I was 5 and she was 4, and we just attached to each other. And so she, one of the first moments of like humanity that I remember, it was on my 21st birthday. And she brought in her 2-month-old baby, Gabriella. And, you know, I had already been in prison for 7 years. And I held that baby. I held her. And I saw the innocence in the purity. I believe that children are the closest you can get to God's love. That they're pure until we teach them how to not be pure. Until we take that from them. And I remember holding my sister and holding Gabriella. And I remember her sobbing. She didn't want to leave me in there. And, you know, we were allowed to hug when they came in. We were allowed to have chips out of the vending machine and hold hands across the table. But I was holding the baby the whole time. And we took some pictures. But other than that, there was just so much basic human rights that you're denied. What I mean by that is physical contact. You're not allowed to hug. You can't kiss somebody on the cheek. You know, you can ask permission, but for the most part, when you ask, they scoff at you like you're an idiot. You know? And it's, you know, they look at you like it's all sexual. Like you're going to jump in the middle of a day room and have a big orgy in front of their face. You know? And I've been sold in and almost taken to the hole for hugging someone who actually ended up on hospice and died in there. Well, technically she died in the hospital. She was transported out to the hospital where she went into a cardiac arrest and died. But I hugged her and got like a 72-hour cell in because she was in the medical pod and I was walking through. And she had been isolated in the infirmary for a really, really long time. And so I saw her and she was like, "I love you, Jessica." And I was like, "I love you, Mary." And I ran up and she's like, "Don't hug me. I don't want to get in trouble." And I was like, "I will tell them that I forced my hug on you." And so I did. I hugged her. She's like, "I miss you." And I was like, "I miss you too, honey. I love you." And this big lieutenant comes out. "Tibbetts, what are you doing?" And I was like, "Stanton, what are you doing?" And I'm like, "I did it. She didn't have anything to do with it. She didn't want that hug. I forced it on her." I said that. Like, I didn't force it, but I said that to protect her because, you know, she didn't want to get in trouble. And she said that, but she loved me and she needed a hug. The woman had been isolated back there for like 5 months, not able to be around anyone that she really cared about, sick, alone, you know, and I just wasn't having that. She died about 6 months later in there. But that was life in there, you know. The food is really bad, obviously, which you're not expecting the Hilton, but you know, make it, if you're going to waste the money on the food, at least make it edible. right? And don't make it something that's going to kill all of us in the next 10 years. And, you know, the whole segregation, I guess they've doubled up the bunks in there now because they're running out of space. But, you know, I don't know how it is with another person in your cell. Every time I did seg time, I was in a cell by myself. A lot of times I was in a closed soup cell, which means closed supervision, which means that it has a doorway set back from the rest of the unit. And then there's a second door that goes out in front of it. So it's the one steel door that whoosh, bam, locks. And then there's another one, whoosh, bam, that locks. So it's your concrete cell and then another concrete little room and then the actual pod area. And every time you go out of your cell, if you're in segregation, they have, I don't remember, oh, they call it a tether. They call it a tether. We call it a dog leash, where they literally take something that looks exactly like a dog leash and you have to turn around backwards and bend down and put your wrists through the meal slot, which they call the cuff port. And they clip the dog leash onto that. The cuff port opens and then they open the door and you have to walk out backwards with a leash on the handcuffs that they have on you, and then they walk you to the shower, or for your 1 hour of rec time you can have 5 hours a week out of your cell. But other than that, you are allowed, what was it, three or five books, 5 pieces of paper, 1 pen, 1 comb, 2 blankets, 1 roll of toilet paper, 5 pads if you are a girl, and that's it. You get your 3 meals. That's all. Nothing else. You can't see anyone else. You can't talk to anyone else. You can if you go up and you stand on your bunk and you talk through the vent to the person who's in the cell above you, if you have somebody in the cell above you. But it's just isolation. I mean, it's essentially, I mean, just a little bit more classy than being buried alive, I'd imagine. But it's, I've seen so many people that have actually died from suicide in there. As a juvenile going in with an indeterminate sentence, I went in as a child. And for a long time, I couldn't get over the fact that I may never, ever know what it's like to live out in the real world. I may never see that. And I attempted suicide a couple of times. And people say, well, you never really attempt suicide. It's just an attention thing until it works. Well, no, that's not exactly true. I took over 300 pills with apple juice so that I knew that the acid would actually dissolve them. And I had to be transported to a hospital. I was in a coma for 3 days. You know, I was very bent on what I was doing. And there was no explanation for why I survived. The mixture of pills I took, like one of them was to lower my blood pressure, and I took over 80 of them. And I weighed like 130 pounds. So there's no reason that I survived that other than the Creator was not ready for me to go. You know, he was like, I'm not done with you.
That was Jessica Tibbetts. She was the youngest person in Oregon to have been convicted and sentenced under Measure 11's mandatory minimum scheme. We'll have more of Jessica's story in a future show. You can listen to this and previous installments of Prison Pipeline at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. My thanks to Jessica Tibbetts for sharing her story. Thanks also to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. And of course, thank you, dear listener, for tuning in. I'm Doug McVeigh. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is currently hiring for the following 3 positions: Station Manager, Evening News and Public Affairs Director, and Director of Underwriting. To apply to one of these positions, send a cover letter and resume to hiring@kbu.org, or bring or mail your resume with cover letter to 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer the following question. Why is KBU important? Open until filled. Interviews will begin around December 9th. No phone calls, please. KBU Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. For more information, go to kboo.org.
Give to KBOO today during our end-of-year match. Wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a new member, and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KBOO. Thank you.
It's 7 p.m. here at KBOO Portland. It's time for Hard Knock Radio, so stay tuned.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?